I don't believe the evidence would support a claim that there is a real explosion of litigation. And that's been argued and discussed, and many of the materials we've submitted to you will supply that, and I'm not going to go through it in detail. There's lots of statistics on all sides. But we do agree, and we have recognized in our proposals, that whether it has anything to do with an insurance crisis or not, and we think it does not, the question of lawsuits being filed that have no business being filed is worth a look. And this system we have that we think has a lot of good features isn't perfect and probably is subject to some improvement. And frivolous litigation is one of the places where you should take a serious look at what you can do to improve it. I don't think this particular provision, and that's Section 6 of this bill, is the way to go about it. To my knowledge, there are three alternatives in front of you in one way or another that are addressed to this question. One of them is Section 3B of our Oregon Insurance Affordability Act, which I held up a minute ago, which is a proposal to create a kind of an early screening device in the malpractice field, especially where a lot of this hue and cry arises, as a means of filtering those cases out cheaply and efficiently without creating such a chilling effect on good cases that people can't afford to bring the ones that they should be bringing. And that was our proposal. That's not the only way to skin a cat. I believe the interim task force, and I can't tell you exactly where it appears in a bill, but I know that the interim task force adopted a proposal to create a state rule version of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure number 11. And I think Mr. Chairman can probably tell people better than I can where that appears. But when you get a chance to look at that bill, and I'm not speaking for the Trial Lawyers Association when I say this, but in my personal opinion, that is a workable solution. It works in other jurisdictions. It works in the federal courts. It works in Washington State. It gives a means of recovering costs and attorney's fees to the party who has been sued frivolously. And it embodies a lot of real hard thought process and language by a lot of committees of lawyers to come down with that federal rule that take account of a lot of the concerns we should be talking about here. Do you create such an effect that a person with a good case can't afford to bring it or risk it because of the backlash that they're going to get into? And that federal rule allows for flexibility in the law. It allows for novel theories of law to be pursued when they are in good faith worth pursuing. And I just think it has a lot
Senator to do. Wires, did you say you're talking about 3B?
3B of the Oregon Insurance Affordability Act is the proposal that we have made aimed at the frivolous lawsuit problem. My discussion right now, federal
statute medical malpractice is talking about a settlement conference.
Yes, that's the screening device that that is the one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Within 180 days of the filing of the notice of claim.
Lyle wrote it. Yeah, that's the one that I'm just suggesting you take a better look at that than you do at this one, Section 6.
To say this very, very briefly, mm-hmm. Are you saying that by having a settlement conference early on, you're going to get rid of the spurious lawsuits quicker, or how would you say it in two sentences? What the meat of the nut is there?
If you wouldn't mind, Senator Wires, I'd like to let sure. Lyle address that either now or later. That it happens that Lyle Valeur chaired the committee that adopted most of the provisions and wrote that one. So.
Don't want to slow you down.
Okay. I'll go on with mine if that's okay with you, and then he'll have time to make a comment on that. I started to say there are three options available to you on the frivolous lawsuit. Question one is that bill of ours. Two is the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11, and three is this one that we're talking about, which is the reversing the special damages rule. Let me tell you that the special damages rule in Oregon is a creature of common law. It's the common law of most states. It is best discussed in an opinion of our Supreme Court called Franklin versus O'Toole, which goes into great description of why it's there and what difference it makes and why it should be there. The practical effect of this provision that I want to leave with you without going any longer at it is that it creates a substantial probability of endless litigation. It says if I don't like the fact that you sue me, I can sue you back just because you sued me. And if you don't like the fact that I sued you back, you can sue me back just because I sued you. And neither of us have to prove special injury. Neither of us have to prove that we were put upon any worse than anybody else is who happens to have a lawsuit filed against them and incurs the costs of litigation. And this is well recognized historically in the courts as a threat to the whole court process and the court administration and the efficiency of it. And you take down the special damage rule, and I sue a doctor and he doesn't like it when it's over with, and he happens to win, as they do 80% of the time in those cases that go to trial. He turns around and sues me and my client. He may not win. We may have been in good faith and can prove it, but he can sue us. And the litigation can go on and doesn't get thrown out because we've eliminated the special injury rule. He loses his case against me. I can turn around and sue him because I didn't like what he did to me and because I knew I was in good faith in the first place, even though we lost. And it goes on and on and on. And you create a nightmare of additional litigation by this provision. That's my main point.
Senator Wyers, Lyle Valeur, and I would just like to discuss that Section 3B and what I think is behind the frivolous lawsuit issue. The frivolous lawsuit issue is primarily a concept that the physicians have come up with the idea that there's a lot of frivolous medical negligence cases out there. There are in Oregon a lot more medical negligence cases filed than should ever need to be filed or should ever be filed. I'll tell you that right now. But the reason for that is not a bunch of lawyers out there running around wanting to sue doctors, because they are the most difficult and the most expensive cases in the world that we handle. I'm sure my colleague Charlie Burt can tell you that, and the legislation is already in effect, which limits us to the smallest attorney fee that we can collect on contingent fees, because there's no graduated scale on attorney fees in medical negligence cases. We're limited to a straight one-third by statute at this time. What we attempted to do in the Insurance Affordability Recovery Act is to solve the problem, because the problem is brought about not by lawyers or by greedy litigants because of the great expense of medical negligence cases, but it's frankly brought about because of the complete failure and refusal of the major insurance carrier who write medical malpractice insurance in this state to enter into any type of serious settlement negotiations prior to the filing of a lawsuit and, quite frankly, going right down to the eve of trial. About a month ago, I tried a case in Coos County for a young lady, an orthopedic surgeon, got his surgeries mixed up, and he thought he was doing surgery on a man's ankle rather than on the side of a woman's foot. And he opened up this young lady's ankle joint, and he realized that there was nothing wrong with his ankle joint, and then all of a sudden realized, I guess, that he was doing surgery on a woman rather than a man and in the wrong place. That insurance company stonewalled us on that case, stonewalled the young lady completely until she had to go to a lawyer, stonewalled us on the case until 2 days before trial, before they would discuss negotiations. They called us and they made us an offer of $10,000, which did not consider any of this young lady's. There were a lot of, may sound like a lot of money for just a scar on her ankle, but the scar developed, she happened to be a keloid former, and it developed neuromas and developed problems and things of that nature. And she happened to be a medical personnel herself, and she had believed all this publicity, according to her psychiatrist, about that doctors do not commit malpractice. And she went into a depressive reaction, a severe depressive reaction, where she had to be placed on antidepressants. All of the testing indicated that she was not malingering, not faking, or anything. They called up, offered us $10,000 2 days before trial, told us not to call back unless it was to accept the check, that this was a non-negotiable offer. We went down and we tried the case, and the Coos County jury was out 29 minutes and gave this young lady $104,000, which they should have given her. It was a very justified verdict in that case. But what we have attempted to do with that Section 3B that you mentioned, Senator Wyers, is to solve both problems with one piece of legislation. That is, require all lawyers, and if there are young lawyers out there who are filing lawsuits without getting experts against doctors prior to filing it, forcing them to prove that they have an expert that will support their case prior to going into trial, where they have to have some pre-filing justification. And we felt it's much better than to try to convene panels or anything like that of blue ribbon panels to go right to the courts and do that.
Mm-hmm. Last session, the OMA had a bill in wanting the plaintiff to have to have an affidavit from a medical expert, and that was, as I recall, opposed by at least some of the members of the Trial Lawyers Association. How is this requirement that the plaintiff's lawyer show he has a doctor ready to testify?
Because it's a different situation, Senator Wires. In that instance, it was a disclosure of an expert and disclosure of a theory prior to going in. And quite frankly, that's one of the things that I think OTLA has consistently opposed and I have opposed, is disclosure of experts, because once you have disclosure of experts, you're going to lose that expert.
That's what is the plaintiff's lawyer going to do?
Swear that he's got one?
Swear that he's got one and that expert supports this theory and, in essence, set out his specifications of negligence in that affidavit is our idea. The defendant, likewise, must come in and say what their defense is and file an affidavit saying that they have an expert who will support their theories of defense. And then the court will convene within a certain period of time, and this would toll the statute of limitations, a settlement conference where all parties must be present and they must sit down and bargain in good faith before a lawsuit is ever filed. Now, this does place a burden on judges, but we're headed towards more and more settlement conferences in circuit courts of the state of Oregon anyway. Chief Justice Peterson is in favor of those. Judge Abram in Klamath Falls, when he took over as presiding judge in Klamath and Lake Counties, had some 3,000 pending cases. Through the judicious use of settlement conferences, he's reduced that to about 800 pending cases now, one of the most efficiently run circuit courts in the state. And we've attempted to build this in through that section in doing it. I also would point out that I don't think anyone else pointed this out, ORS 20.105 gives you all the protections that you need against frivolous lawsuits anyway, if it were used, and it's a two-way, we already have that in legislation, and it's a two-way situation, because not only does it give the defendant protection on attorney fees against actions brought in bad faith, but it gives the plaintiffs protection against defendants who defend in bad faith or to appeal in bad faith. Cases where they absolutely don't have any appealable grounds and they go on to the appellate courts and just stall. I was going to discuss that under prejudgment interest, but I think it also has to play here because you do have existing legislation. I would say there's four, with the existing legislation, there are four solutions to this supposed problem, which I'm not too sure exists. And you have, in 323, I believe, have placed the worst of the four potential solutions, the one that carries the most grounds for abuse, and the one that can actually increase the costs of defense because of this thing keeping going, and thereby raise insurance premiums rather than to have its intended effect. I'm supposed to keep going on Section 7. Lyle Valer again. And when I first looked at this section, I thought you were trying to, I thought, hey, there's nothing wrong with this. This is a good deal. Anybody who's engaged in a felony maybe shouldn't recover. And then I got to thinking about it a little bit and thinking about a few cases that I've had and talking to some other lawyers on cases that they have had. And I became bothered by it because, as a practical matter, if a person is engaged in a serious felony at this time, robbing a store with a gun and a police officer or a store owner shoots them, as a practical matter, they're not going to win that case, and no lawyer who has a brain in his head is really going to file that type of case. And so it's really not going to have any real effect. But, you know, I really got concerned because what we're doing here is giving people a license to kill. And that really concerned me, whether it be a private citizen or a police officer or what have you, because Anybody that they happen to shoot is certainly going to be engaged in a felony at the time that they're shot. I have a young son. I know that young men, and I think that one story that maybe some of you know, that there's a very prominent television announcer in the sports field who was engaged in a felony when he was attending the University of Oregon several years ago, and he was apprehended and paid his price went on to become a very famous professional football player. He's engaged in a felony at Memorial Coliseum. He wasn't shot, but if he'd shot, it certainly would have destroyed a life. But I've had cases where young people have been engaged in minor felonies, such as eluding things, where actually they have been shot with a careful pattern in the back of their head, or four bullets about that far apart, where somebody said they were attempting to just wing them. And it does give me some concern because of the abuse that could come about. I noticed that in Section 3 that you said nothing in this section affects any right of action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, and of course we all think we could go into the court and unite what we call 1983 actions. That's not so true anymore that we can. Justice O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States in the early 80s, and I'm sorry, I don't have the citation on the case, issued an opinion which was adopted by the court, and I think that court is going to be even more restrictive on it, really limiting your rights to get into federal court on 1983 actions, where now you must prove that it's a continued policy, say of a police department or a municipal body or a public body or something of that nature, in order to even get past a motion for summary judgment on 1983 actions. And so the 1983 action really isn't available to those citizens, and I'm just very, very concerned that Section 7 could lead itself to abuses and defenses are not good for the citizens of Oregon and like that. The, you know, we always try to find something good and everything, but I guess I was trying to find something bad here that really bothered me on that. On the other hand, too, I don't think that this Section 7 whatsoever will have any effect on availability or affordability of insurance, because it's intended, I assume, primarily for municipalities, and they already have a cap. When we heard at the Going Broke and Going Bare conference in the municipality section, they said that the existence of the cap there made no difference whatsoever on the cost or availability of insurance in Oregon anyway. So I don't think that you're going to accomplish anything in the way of solving the so-called insurance crisis by Section 7, but you're putting something in there that could be abused.
Charles Byrd, I'd like to speak to that just very briefly, too, because I happen to have pending at the present time two cases, one involving a 15-year-old boy who was stealing a golf cart in broad daylight. They knew who he was. They were a 14 and a 15-year-old. The 15-year-old was shot to death by the arresting police officer, shot in the head at very close range. I have an 18-year-old who was obviously very drunk on a public highway and was shot five times in the back, did survive, and that case is pending. And without going into any more details, those are cases that quite probably may fall through the cracks in the 1983 litigation, because you have to show a continuing deprivation of a civil right, and it's pretty hard to show a continuing course of conduct when you only shoot a guy once and you kill him. Unless you can show that the police department has been doing it regularly, and that's almost impossible. So these things, I think, do give rise to some real problems, particularly in areas of minors and sometimes in areas of minority people who are being arrested. I think it's a real clear danger. That's all I have on that one.
Bill Gaylor, just one very brief comment on that. I think you have to recognize that the criminal statutes that create the felons and the felonies are created for purposes totally different than civil liability. And this statute would mix and blend those purposes and in a way abrogate your legislative oversight of civil liability in favor of whatever criminal statutes happen to be on the books in any jurisdiction that applies. Federal, where a false credit application is a felony. Failure to file a tax return is a felony. Or whatever jurisdiction. And it's just, it's not good social policy to have that be the standard that says some people don't have equal justice in the courts and the same rights and remedies that others do. Juries are perfectly good at drawing those lines and making those distinctions, and they don't give large awards for people that you wouldn't agree to give an award for because they were in the course of a felony when they were injured.
I'm Lyle Vlerga, and I'm supposed to talk on Section 8 on prejudgment interest. Of course, we have consistently been in favor of prejudgment interest, and I kind of got into it by telling you the story about my case in Coos County just before this. But I think that if you are going to consider tort reform, that tort reform is a two-way street. And I think that things that encourage people to resolve their differences out of the actual courtroom setting should be in any consideration of so-called tort reform. I don't think that in any way that if you're going to consider this bill as a whole that this should be considered separately but should be considered as part of the package, because I feel that if we're having considerations of congestion in courtrooms, too many cases being filed, too many cases not being disposed of, those types of things, it's a two-way street. And I think this is very true in the medical negligence arena, that possibly the existence of prejudgment interest will give some consideration to these people not stalling out negotiations on cases. I might add that there's a reason for that stalling in medical negligence cases from a defense standpoint, if I might, in this prejudgment interest section. The reason for that is that it weeds out all the small cases. There are a lot of people who have been victims of medical negligence and who have been ill for a period of 5 to 6 months, very, very ill. But another doctor, for example, has come in and discovered the first doctor's negligence and done a great job, cleaned them up, and they have no permanent injury. That person goes uncompensated in Oregon at this time, because quite simply we know that if we file that case, we're going to have to go all the way to the eve of trial, and that we cannot predict a large enough verdict to have incurred all of the expense of going to the eve of trial. Many lawyers will tell you that they will not handle a case of medical negligence unless it reaches a certain level, predictability level, monetarily. Prejudgment interest, I think, would have some salutary effect in that type of case where citizens of Oregon who are victims of tortious conduct because their injuries do not include a permanent injury, a permanent disability, a lasting disability, or a lengthy period of disability are going uncompensated. They're victims. They should have the right to be compensated the same as other wrongdoers. And I think that prejudgment interest will go towards solving part of the problem, which is the refusal of some insurance companies to get in and take care of their business in a rapid fashion as far as negotiating settlements on these cases and intentionally stalling these cases so that the plaintiffs have to incur substantial costs, thereby eliminating a great number of cases. And I think that's a better solution together with the settlement conferences and things of this nature towards this whole concept of excessive litigation or frivolous litigation than the other concepts that have been proposed.
I'm Bill Gaylord. I have one example I want to mention on the prejudgment interest question. I had a case a couple of years ago in a malpractice situation where I thought I was going to save the system and my client and everybody else a lot of time and money. I was willing to take a lower fee and to get the case done in a streamlined fashion because I knew it was an open and shut case of liability. And I represented a little girl who had a permanently paralyzed arm, and I knew that the evidence was overwhelming. There just wasn't any room for it to be defended successfully, and that she was entitled to money, and we ought to quickly get to that point and discuss how much. I went to the insurance adjuster who represented the company for the defendant. I told him I was going to treat this case differently, and I handed him my entire file. And I said, you can have anything you want to know about my case. I'll tell you everything you want to know. You can take whatever number of weeks or months you need to evaluate the case. I won't file it in the meantime, and then let's talk about settlement. And I'll take a lower fee, and you'll take a lot less trouble and expense, and we'll have this over with. He called me back 6 weeks later and said he'd had the case reviewed by two doctors who told him it was indefensible. That's the only time I've ever had that experience. He couldn't find a doctor, even for the defendant, to say that the case was not defensible. He said, it's just a matter of how much. I'll get back to you with an offer as soon as I can. I've submitted my proposals to the company, and we'll talk very soon about that. And I thought that was fine, and we'd all done a good day's work. 3 months later, I hadn't heard back from him, so I contacted him, and he said, I'm still waiting to hear from the company. 3 months after that, I contacted him. Same story. 3 months after that, he told me that he was thinking about threatening to resign from the company because of this and several other claims that they hadn't taken action on. 3 months after that, he didn't have a response. I filed the lawsuit. We took depositions. 8 months later, they made us a proposal, and we discussed it for a while, and after a month or so, settled the case. Never at any time was there any basis for them to defend that case except to stall and hold on to their money. This happened to be back when the interest rates hadn't broken yet, and they were making a lot of money on the time. This prejudgment interest bill idea is as important now as it was when the legislature passed it last session. I know there's been some discussion about whether it belongs in this bill. I think two things to say about that. I think it does have an impact on the responsibility and profitability of the insurance business. I think sometimes we have to force them to do things better for themselves, and I think this is one of those instances. I also think it's important to characterize what this, all of these proposals are about. We, and I mean the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, came to the interim legislative process with a comprehensive package. I think perhaps ours is the only one that attempted to say what should be done to solve this crisis from all of the different aspects that it can be looked at, including insurance reform, including changes in the tort compensation system where it can be improved, including changes in the way lawyers do business and are regulated. This is an integral part of that package, and it needs to be. And I understand, I wasn't here, but I understand some of the opponents of this provision have said this doesn't belong in this bill, or that this is, first off, it's not a good idea, and secondly, it shouldn't be in this bill. And I just want to submit that you take a phrase like tort reform and you build it up with national publicity for a couple of years, and it gets kind of a life of its own. And I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander. This may be tort reform that some of the tort reformers don't like because it actually benefits, in some senses, the victims of tort injury, while I think benefiting the system. So I think it does belong here. I think it's a perfectly fair thing to have considered as part of the package of things that you look at for a comprehensive solution to these problems.
Yes, Charles Burt, I'm going to very briefly address Section 10. We support Section 10. Actually, as written, it's...
I'm sorry. Senator Hill.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, Charlie. Before we move away from prejudgment interest, yesterday we had a witness from the insurance industry who presented us with a study that indicated that most of the delay was caused by plaintiffs. And I guess not having a lot of experience in the area, it would seem that there could be some cases where some of it's caused by the plaintiff and other cases caused by the defendant. What about the idea of allowing the judge to determine who, if anyone, is delaying the case and imposing prejudgment interest as a discretionary matter?
I'd like to speak to that, if I may. First of all, it puts a real impossible burden on the judge because the judge can't tell from looking at the file who's delaying it. To know what is holding up a case, you have to, first of all, know what the case is about. And the judge looks at the pleadings, and he knows that there's 25 motions filed against a complaint, but he doesn't know whether there's any good reason for those 25 motions. By the same token, he looks at the case, he doesn't know whether that claim ultimately is supported by really strong evidence or whether it has no evidence to support it at all. And in order to make a determination that it either is or isn't being delayed, he'd have to know those things, which become very difficult for him to know. I suggest to you that the prejudgment interest is an automatic device because it relates back to the date the claim is filed by this section. If the case is no good, it'll never come into being anyway. And if the case is valid and good, it'll go back to the date it was filed and increase the amount of damages by at least the interest rate, you see. One final thing. There is absolutely, plaintiffs work on a contingent fee basis. We don't get paid until we get the money in our hand. If we don't get any money, we don't get any salary. Now you tell me why we would want to stall a case. We enjoy starvation? That's all we'd be getting for it. If I don't process cases through to a completion and put some money in my client's pocket, I don't have anything to spend. And so I have no incentive, none at all, to hold up a case. On the other hand, the insurance company that's got the reserves that are earning tax-free interest perhaps does have. I categorically say to you, no plaintiff in his right mind is going to make a living by stalling his cases. He's simply going to starve. He doesn't get paid.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, something just occurred to me. There's a statute somewhere in the 20s that says in cases involving, I think it's up to a low amount, $5,000 or $10,000, that there's an offer made.